three ball from CG43. They're in front.
This is flat out ridiculous.
From the beautiful left hand, in and out finish, the old fashioned way.
Newell gets to the basket with one to come. From there again. You have got to be kidding me. Tyson Steph.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. Today, my guest is from The Process. It's Paul Shirley, former NBA player, former guest of this program, and author of Can I Keep My Jersey? Stories I Tell on Dates, and most recently, Ball Boy. Paul is a really sweet guy. He's now taken the time for me and this program twice to talk SHIT, and I really appreciate that and this chat, as well as his new book. There's a strong message to Ball Boy, and that message in a COVID world is greatly applicable and exaggerated. And that message is about community. I don't want to go into too great a depth. You'll hear more about that and why it's important. This episode, though, is for people who have read the book. It's also for people who are thinking about buying the book and want to know a little bit of what's it about. And it's also for people who are maybe both of those two things and something more, but people who are considering writing a book of their own. Paul and I go into great detail about pretty much every facet of this book's creative life cycle that hopefully you can either imitate or take inspiration from. Before we jump into this episode, some front of house stuff. If you're interested in buying Ball Boy, do it via the link in the description. If you like the show and want to support it, please do become a patron in the Corner Pocket Patron tier. That link is also in the description. And if you are inspired to buy any book, be it Ball Boy or otherwise, do it via the Booktopia link in the description. Booktopia is a totally Australian-based book emporium, so they're quite predictable with their delivery times and prices. And lastly, rate, review, and most importantly of the three, subscribe to the show so when a new one comes out, you may listen to it. Some more front of house stuff on this podcast. This podcast will be releasing this episode, another nuts and bolts of the NBL podcasting sphere episode, not about basketball. It's going to be more about podcasting and how it relates to the NBL. Get a bit of a look behind the curtain of how this program works and it's positioned within the space of second tier NBL media. And then also we may do one last episode talking shite about the NBL 21 season. And then after that, we're going to take a lengthy break before the start of next season, and we're looking forward to that. But forget all that. It's now time to focus on Paul Shirley, the Ball Boy.
I did. I saw that writer's block. I think I saw it on your Instagram, a photograph of you, the doors shut. It was quite a sorrowful Instagram post. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was, I'm still in this period of transition, so I'm coping in a lot of ways. I think it's hard sometimes for people to understand what it's like to build a business, in that it's a lot like going through a relationship. There's the early stages of excitement of like, is this going to go anywhere? And then there's kind of some, not necessarily drudgery, but there's just like, we got to work on this and make it go. And then I think at some point it starts to soar, and it felt like writer's block had gone through that. We did it for 8 years. And it started really ad hoc. You know, it was just me and some wine and some chocolate at a friend's coffee shop. And then we got serious about it and it was starting to really hum. We had 150 members and we had figured out like how to talk about it and how to explain it to people. And then COVID hit and everything got locked down and there was just almost no way forward. So that was a struggle. It was, you know, in some ways fortuitous that our lease was up when it was, because we were able to get out of there. And I've since moved to Denver, where I'm setting up a headquarters for this thing called The Process, which takes what we learned about writer's block, which is that people want accountability and community with their work, but extends it beyond writers to really anybody trying to finish a big project, freelancers, creatives, those sorts of people.
Yeah, right. So I'm assuming, writer's block, the thing that led to its demise was 100% COVID?
Yeah. I mean, it was just there, like when you're not allowed to be open, it is really hard to run a business. We were able to like take ourselves online. And I think with The Process, we've learned a lot about what is scalable to a lot of the online coaching that we're doing. But from a physical standpoint, like in, and I think the hard thing for people to see or to understand about starting a business in general is like, you know, I took out loans that I'm going to get to repay for a long time. Mm-hmm. That conceivably in those next 2, 3, 4 years, we were going to really get our head above water. And
with a physical place for writer's block, not an online writer's block.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So we had, you know, like it, there was a lot of startup cost of like buying furniture and all of that.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, right. Of course.
So yeah, it's, my life is kind of a shambles right now, but we'll, I've been here before.
Let me tell you this. I've been reading, I obviously finished your book. I have it here. I mean, we'll talk about this, but I mean, the fact that a copy of your book has made it all the way to Sydney, Australia. I mean, it's a long, that's a success in itself, but we'll come back to that. You talked about shambles of a life. I don't know if that's totally true, but I read Into the Wild recently. I'd watched the film. I'd followed that story. You know, the book of your Into the Wild. Mm-hmm. And there's a great little line in it from John Krakauer. And I actually don't have it near me, but it's something like, he talks about how he personally, the author, left and did some climbing expedition in Alaska. And he says like he was shocked and exhilarated by how easy and exciting it was to start all over again. He thought it was going to be impossible to lose the job and this and that. And then when he did it, he was like, oh, actually, this is not only really easy, but a heck of a lot of fun. So
yeah,
that's a
book. You know, I mean, I'm excited about like that. I sold so much of my stuff in LA just personally. And put so much of it in the trash, honestly. Right. A lot of old basketball stuff.
Typings or books or jerseys?
No, I mean like actual pairs of practice shorts from the zillions of teams that I played for, you know. In a lot of ways, the last 10 years of my life have been the post basketball years, like kind of figuring out what is going to come next. And that's hard to relate to people because a lot of times, you know, most humans aren't going to run an entire career before they're 33 years old. Right.
Yeah.
You may have to switch careers. Like you may change and most of us will,
but it's not an end. Yeah. It's not like is over. Like I was a carpenter and now I'm an electrician. I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think like I'm still coming to terms with, I'm 43 now. And to me that feels young, but to the world, it starts to feel a little older. And so there's this like shift in my head of like, oh, okay. So, you know, how do I deal with that? And how do I make sense of it?
Yeah. I saw you did a podcast with Bogut and I think Andrew Bogut, I think he's coming through a little bit of that at the minute. Well, he's mm-hmm. 34 and 2 years out of it. And yeah, I'm sure it's not an easy transition. The first thing I have is you've had a change of life. You've moved from Los Angeles to Denver. What inspired that change other than writer's block? And also the change does mirror closely the main character in Ball Boy.
Oh yeah, that's true. Fitting. It's funny. Like if you write fiction and then it comes true, I think there's a Jumanji situation. A lot of needing to get out of Los Angeles is because LA has become a hellscape and I didn't want to be there anymore.
COVID and physical hellscape or an emotional people are terrible there, so on and so forth.
Well, I think the lockdowns really, I think, threw into clarity how, like without the people, LA sucks. Like it's not a pretty city. It's not really a beach town.
I've been there before. I was so underwhelmed when I went there. I thought this is one of the grimiest, dirtiest cities. This is supposed to be Hollywood. This is the opposite of Hollywood. Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah. And so now that like there is a massive homeless situation in Los Angeles. And I think that because of COVID, everybody in government just forgot that they needed to like take care of anything. I think it just like kind of opened my eyes. LA has always had its struggles, but I just, you know, just couldn't do it anymore. And it's so refreshing to be somewhere else. I'm scared and worried about what is going to happen here and how I will manage it. But I've also been scared and worried a lot in my life. So I think that past history of having to pick myself up and go from team to team helps me in these situations because I'm able to say, all right, you've been in these mind states before and you'll probably get through it. But it's, you know, I think it's important for us to be able to talk about how frightening some of these things are, having to restart, having to reinvent ourselves. And that's where I am right now, which is, like you said, it's exciting, from the standpoint of like, winnowing down to things that are important, but there is a little less margin for error than there used to be. I think when you're younger, there is a sense of like, well, you know, there's lots of ways that my life can go. And at this point, there's that feeling of, I probably need to figure some stuff out.
Yeah, right. Now, before we talk about Ball Boy and what you've done, what are you doing? What are you currently working on? And I mean, like your next novel, what is it? If there is one.
So I'm going back to nonfiction first. There's a book coming out. We actually haven't announced this fully yet, so we can talk about it. This will be almost like an announcement.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So there's a book called The Process is the Product, which will be out in December of this year. And it's my sort of manifesto on this idea of, if you can fall in love with the process, then that becomes the thing that is your quote product, right? And that along the way you will achieve all of these goals and things will happen, but as soon as you start thinking about those goals and those achievements, you're kind of screwed. And so this is something that, like, it's partially, and then a lot of it is my sports background of like learning how to do something day after day. But I don't think I would have felt comfortable talking about it or writing about it until I screwed up writing. It was the realization that writing is the same as basketball. And so therefore everything is the same as both of these things, in that whether it's public speaking or podcasting or learning how to do conditional formatting in Excel.
Piano, yeah.
It's always comes down to this idea of doing something day after day and then figuring out why you love that day to day and letting go of the end results.
I got a couple of square questions for you to go on to Ball Boy. Did you get an advance to write it? Was it a passion project? Is it selling well? The commercial element of Ball Boy, if you're comfortable talking about that, how's it going?
Love to. The commercial element is bad because nobody reads fiction. Nobody cares about fiction. No. It's I think so. Like I think it's fun to talk about these things mostly because people don't talk about them. Yeah. My first book, which is called Can I Keep My Jersey? As you know,
read it.
Sold around 40,000 copies, which is pretty good for a book. You know, like, you know, we may have talked about this before, the fact that like when my book came out, I was like, I don't know how many books is a lot to sell.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cause you get raised on like movie tickets. You're like, well, you know, the gross was 30 million this week. Yeah. So you don't know, like, there's no sense of like what a book sells. So 40,000 was really pretty good. And I got an advance of $85,000 on that book. How that works is that they give you a third of it when you sign the contract, a third when you deliver the manuscript, and a third when you publish the book. So it usually comes out over like a couple of years. So this is a bit of a long story, but it's, I think, kind of a window into how the publishing world works. My second book, Stories They Tell on Dates, I sent it to like three agents, different from my first agent. And they were all like, yeah, this is good, but you're not going to be able to sell any copies of a memoir unless you're super famous, right? So my first book was like easy to sell because it was professional basketball player.
You were in the NBA at the time. Yeah, it lined up. Yeah.
That's a no-brainer. Second book, which is like stories that I've had about dating that involve a lot of some of the basketball stuff, but it's really about like just traveling and being a person. They're like, nobody cares about this. So I said, all right, well, I don't really enjoy sort of groveling to other people. So I started, quote, my own publishing house in the same way that like musicians started their own indie record label, which means really like I hired a copy editor and a graphic designer and like an assistant. So I started a publishing house called Fourth Bar Books for that second book. And that book sold about, I think it sold around 3,500 copies. But that one I did on my own, so there was no advance. And I spent probably $30,000 getting it done and made back about $15,000, which I thought was a reasonable investment in just learning how a book gets made.
That initial investment of the publishing house and the know-how. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. And so now with ball boy, I did it through, quote, again, my own publishing house, which I keep putting in quotes because, like, it's not like I have, like, there's a Fourth Bar Books building down by the river that's pumping out books or something. Most of the publishing happens through Ingram or Amazon. So ball boy, I've done through that as well. And I figured out how to spend a lot less money doing it. But we also have sold a lot fewer copies because, again, it's fiction and people don't read fiction. So it's probably sold like 500 copies or something, which, and so the fact that you have one of them is so flattering and amazing. And also it means it's pretty rare. There's not a lot of them really, honestly, floating around.
Good point. Good point.
I want to, so hopefully that doesn't like,
no, it does
like take all of the glamour out of publishing for people, or hopefully it does actually. Hopefully it just like,
no, I think it's a physical thing itself. I think that's the glamour of it, that it's here with me. The other question I have is, and this is going to sound really square, but it caught me, like, this is a really nice book to hold, right? Not too thin, not too thick. The cover has a certain, you know, feel to it, like a thin, thinnish front cover. How did you settle on all that sort of stuff? And let's start with this. The actual physical size of it, because you could have had it a bit smaller, you could have had it a bit bigger, a bit thin. How'd you decide on the sides?
Just trial and error. You know who, do you know who Nick Hornby is?
No.
He's a novelist, but he's also had several books that got turned into movies, like About a Boy or High Fidelity.
I mean, I know those films, but no, I don't know him by name. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's how people are. When Stories I Tell on Dates was coming out, I went into this suit rental place because I was trying to find a red vest, because that book had a lot of red in the theme. And for the book launch, I wanted to have a red vest and a black suit. Sure. And I was telling the guy like why I was doing this. And he's like, oh, that's cool. When are they going to make it into a TV show? I was like, man, fuck off. Like, I just finished a book. Do you know how hard that is? Like, anyway, so yes, I know. So Nick Hornby is a novelist who I think does it right, as far as he writes short books. He writes books that are light and kind of easy to read. And that is, I think, my idol when it comes to all of these things, about thinking about, is the book approachable even from the way it looks, from the first paragraph you read? Like, is it easy to figure out where you are? I really struggle with authors who try to be too like authory. I just want people to get into it really quickly and enjoy that experience. Like you're saying, I don't need to write a 600 page book. Nobody cares about that. I was with in LA, a friend of mine who's a grad student. He was talking about working on a thesis and how one of his advisors was reminding him, because it was taking too long, dude, you can always write another one. And I feel that way about books. Like, look, write another one if you need to write 600 pages.
Yeah. Right. Then the other thing is the typeset. So do you go to a little publisher and you feel like, oh, okay, maybe I'll have it this material, that material? You like walking along like there's a book of carpet samples on books, or?
I wish. No, it's, well, so a friend of mine is a graphic designer. And so I've hired him to do this, and he's learned how, in fact, it's funny. He mentioned this to me yesterday. He's in Denver as well. He met with this Australian person just yesterday who lives in Denver, who was thinking about hiring him to do all of this for her book. So.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. So he's like, so, I mean, like, what a world we live in, right? Where you can just find people who can do this stuff.
And then,
what's cool about it too is, like, you and I are talking about this, about how the ins and outs of it, but most people do not care, like, where the book came from. As long as they can order it on Amazon, they're like, yes, let's
get it in the house. The font, I don't recognize the actual font of it, but what is it? How big? And why did you settle on it?
We just lost all of your listeners. They're like, we're talking about fonts.
Absolutely. I think you can't. The further you go, the deeper you go.
Deeper, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like Scott, who's my guy, we have. Okay. So honestly, what we have decided is, generally speaking, if you see all of my books on a bookshelf, I kind of want them to look like they make sense together. Right. Yeah. So if my books are next to each other, you would notice, I don't expect that there's a ton of people out there in the world who own all three of my books, but like way that the spine works is kind of the same. There's like a little, there's a little photo that's like a next to the, like you'll see on ball boy, it's like title and then a basketball, right?
Yeah. It goes ball, the little picture of the basketball and then boy. Yeah.
Yeah. And so with Stories I Tell on Dates, we did something similar with a little
balloon, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then with Can I Keep My Jersey, I can't remember. I think it might be a basketball also. So like, I love having this consistency of like the books are kind of the same. So we actually just have the same typeface in every book because again, it's like, this is the sort of shit I worry about. And I'm happy that we get to talk about it because nobody else cares. That's the sort of thing that I do kind of care about is like making sure that it's consistent because I think as a writer over your career, you're just trying to build a body of work. And at some point somebody's going to be like, oh shit, I want to buy all of this guy's stuff. And I think the more consistency there can be, like the more it, I always kind of come back to music, right? Like I wouldn't love it if, I don't know, Oasis is one of the few bands whose career I've followed and generally had done like a pretty strong body of work. Like I liked that a lot of their imagery was kind of the same. Their logo stayed the same. Like that makes me feel comfortable or confident about what they're producing. And obviously you're going to make mistakes along the way, but like I sort of enjoy, you know, like Nine Inch Nails put out, they would call albums like a numeral.
Yeah,
but right. They were all kind of related vaguely. Like, you know, they would be like, this is, yeah. They weren't sequential necessarily. We're getting way down the rabbit hole, but like, I love that idea of having some continuity or consistency to one's career.
Well, I think that's why books like, that's why Goosebumps, for example, or Harry Potter works so well, because it was this collector's item and it felt good in your hands. And if you look at a line of Goosebumps, the pride when they're all lined up, different color and everything like that. I mean, it got kids. I mean, R.L. Stine, before J.K. Rowling came along,
yeah,
it was kind of a big deal.
You know, it's funny you mention that because I am old enough that I loved Hardy Boys books when I was a kid. Oh, wow.
Well, same principle, right.
And it was the same thing you're talking about. Like they were the same color. They looked the same. They were about the same thickness usually. It was just that like sense of, wow, I'm going to get all of these someday.
Yeah, it's the same thing as like a basketball card, I suppose. Yeah, so I've got all that. I love the powder blue cover. I thought that was a great cover choice. It's a color you don't see in books often. But as I was saying, it feels good in your hands. I read it mainly on flights and in airports, which is the last true wilderness of quiet these days. And it felt good in that space. So
yeah,
that's a success, I think.
Are you seeing people... I'm curious about airplanes because I think people have heralded the end of the book for a long time. But when I'm on an airplane, I'm amazed at how many people are carrying books still, and maybe even more than ever in some ways.
I know for a fact when I have a flight, one of my exciting things about booking a flight is, oh, good, I'll get to read in peace and quiet.
Yeah.
Normally you pull out a book and people see it as a flag to like, oh, no, please. I'm reading a book. Please come over and ask me a question or something like that. Yeah. On this most recent flight, and perhaps this is an Australian thing, but no, I saw very few books because Wi-Fi has come onto planes. And so again, the screen has invaded. What was beautiful was when I finished your book on a flight, I put it down and I was like, oh, okay. Oh, I've jumped the gun a bit earlier. There's a bit time to landing. And then I realized that on that 4 or 5 hour flight, there was Wi-Fi. I thought there wasn't. It's almost like we're talking about Into the Wild. I've left the map at home. You know, I didn't know there was Wi-Fi maybe for a reason. So I could sit with your book or a book.
I'm always amazed that people can sit and do work on an airplane because to me, it seems so distracting. Like I would rather just carve out that time, like you're saying, as this is already going to be stressful enough. Now let me treat myself to a book or an album or whatever it might be.
I think in another book of yours, a piece of advice that I took pretty well was you had, I don't know which one it was, whether it was Keep My Jersey or Stories of Telling Dates, but you had your routine of what you do on an airplane where it's like head music and nothing, music and a magazine and no music. Mm-hmm. I forget what the order was, but I remember thinking, oh, that mirrors myself pretty closely.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I actually wrote a piece just this week about driving. I was driving from San Francisco to Denver and noticing that on one of my segments through Nevada, I was pretty bored. And so I stopped to pick up some sunflower seeds and some bubble gum to try to keep myself awake. And then I got back in the car, not that I was going to eat those at the same time. That'd be super weird. But I was getting back in the car and I was like, okay, so let's get some sunflower seeds in and then we'll get a podcast dialed up and let's have a drink. And then I was like, oh, what am I doing? Like, one of the things I love about long drives is the ability to kind of zone out, just yep. be at peace, like put together like different ideas or brainstorms that aren't necessarily going to lead anywhere. But I feel like there's just kind of this like jostling totally. In a good way that happens. Totally. So I was like, wait, Paul, you're the one who talks about process and mindfulness all the time. Maybe you should just try eating the sunflower seeds and nothing else. And what was interesting was that I got nervous because my brain was like, wait, you're only going to do one thing at a time. That's crazy. So when I got to Reno, that was the next stop. I looked into it and it turns out that we set up in our heads this cortisol, which is the stress hormone. We set up this like system where cortisol then leads to dopamine. So we want to relieve the stress by answering the email or whatever the thing might be. And that gives us a hit of dopamine. So what we can happen is we get addicted to the cortisol because it produces dopamine down the road, right? So like we'll be like agitated. And then be like, oh, stress hormones have hit, but we usually are able to release that by sending the email or checking the phone or whatever it is. And that gives us a dopamine hit. So we actually get addicted to stress. And so I think that's what was happening was my brain was saying, you're going to have withdrawal if you don't give yourself a bunch of stress. And I see that all the time now with people where like, we're just, and I'm the same way. We're all so addicted to like being connected all the time. You know, when I'm waiting to start a podcast with you, why can I not just sit quietly for 3 minutes? Why do I have to go check Twitter? That's stupid. Twitter is not going to make me happy. It's not no. like.
I had that exact thought the other day. I was like, why am I on that platform? Why am I on there? It brings out the worst in me.
And everybody else,
of course.
And I think like it's the first step for all of us is just that we're aware that this is what's going on. And now we can start to potentially like form some support groups. Basically, we're going to have to create like Alcoholics Anonymous
for stress. This mirrors, I mean, have you read that thing, The Ecstasy of Choice or The Burden of Choice, writer by name of Schwartz? It just mirrors that where like every decision, and anyway, we could go into that for a long time, but let's do this. Your opening lines. Every book is, you know, it would be first pick up a book and before you've even bought it, you read the first line. The sun was relentless, a siren whined in the distance, a traffic chopped up, whapped overhead. Why did you choose those opening lines? How long did you spend cultivating them?
Entirely too long. So it's an astute question of you because I think sometimes you can almost get up in your own ass too much about like what's going to be the first line. I think I wanted to show very quickly like what Los Angeles, especially in the San Fernando Valley, can feel like, which is this, it's a little bit bleak. It like reminds me of the video from Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun, where there's just this like kind of end of the earth feeling. And I think like I have to work really hard on remembering to describe the situation because I want to get into the dialogue and like the plot. So that was almost an exercise for myself in saying, this is what it looks like here. And then if I do that, then the reader potentially will come along for the ride of seeing that.
Were you happy with them?
I was not as like the first line to, Stories I Tell on Dates was, I grew up in the country, but not on a farm.
Yeah. I remember coming back to you with that. I was like, that was a interesting little ditty or line. Yep.
Yeah. Which I actually stole from the 4-H registration when I was a kid. So I love that opening line. And with this, I think with this book, I had a little pressure on myself to, think the opening line has to be perfect. So it, again, very inside baseball, but the book originally started with Gray arriving in Baudelaire, Kansas. So like,
why the change?
That was the case for 5 years. And then eventually after thinking about it, reading about it, talking to people, I realized it needed to start with him in LA so we could see what his life was like before.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, because of that, in some ways, the first couple of chapters maybe aren't as like, I don't know, they're not quite as integrated as they might have been if I had started there at the very beginning.
Right. I mean, it's important. Like Los Angeles, I think, is a huge character in this book. Mm-hmm. It is it is their motivation. It is certainly Gray's, you know, he needs that place to then accept his new surroundings or embrace them. So that's interesting. Page 20, you punch in and do like a little script, like you change the text format and you go into a little script.
Oh, yeah, like a
Gray screenplay. Yeah, I would just stylistically, why did you decide to do that?
I think he was just like trying to kind of harken back to the fact that he's in LA for so long. That I think when you're in LA, everybody you meet is writing a screenplay. And so like in Los Angeles, people kind of tend to even think in terms of how screenwriting works. Like I would find myself even saying, and I probably will lose this habit, hopefully, because people around me are probably tired of it. But in movies, if somebody says something like, wow, we're going to have a great night tonight, and then it'll like smash cut to car or crash,
shadowing
like, us, whatever the thing is. Right. So like, I will actively say, if somebody says something like, wow, I'm really looking forward to this dinner, I'll be like, oh, smash cut to food poisoning. Cause that's just how screenplays work, you know? So I think it's like, it's such a Los Angeles thing to be thinking in terms of like, how would this look on the screen? Mm.
The other one I had is Baudelaire. You have a conversation where two characters pin down the pronunciation of a relatively difficult word to pronounce or location, which becomes a major character. I know as a reader, I really appreciate it because sometimes you go through a book and you get to the end, you're like, fuck, what, is her name Hermione or Hermione? Like what? Did you do that with that in mind?
Probably, because I had that same debate when I read Harry Potter. I thought her name was like Hermione.
You're a human being. I'd never met a Hermione. I'd never met one since.
No, I still haven't. I mean, yeah, I think
there'll be a slew of them. You know that. Yeah. There'll be every second girl we called Hermione in the next 10 years. Sorry, yeah, I'm interrupting.
That's probably a very, that's exactly correct. There was a little debate because Baudelaire, like the author, is spelled a little differently. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't know why I spelled it this way. I think it was because there's a cafe in Ames, Iowa that's spelled Cafe Baudelaire like that, like it is in my book. And I think I just took it from that. I don't know. So some of these things, like they just happen. And like people, I'm thinking about this a lot with this next book, because there's a lot of me referencing other authors or thinkers or whatever. And I'm like, I'm going to screw this up for sure. Like somebody's going to be like, that wasn't the exact quote. And I'm going to just have to be like, sorry, man, I don't know. Like I did my best.
But the idea to have two characters like fight over the pronunciation or one correct one and then spell it phonetically, was that a writing technique that someone said, oh, actually I've done a pre-read of your book and I think it's, I don't know how that's pronounced. And you put that in, or you just foreshadowed that? No,
I think it was more like, just that it felt like Gray would probably not know, and so therefore the reader probably would not know, and so therefore
organic
they need to know. Yeah, like one thing that I've thought a lot about, like I think it's one of the cool things about any kind of fish out of water story, which is what this is that the reader and the protagonist can potentially be finding out things together. And that's one of the
Luke Skywalker character that you take the journey with. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I think like there's always that value. We talked about this next book, which is called The Process is the Product, but my next novel is about a rock band. And in this novel, this band has broken up and now they're going to get back together for one last hurrah. And because the band already knows the world of music, I had to introduce a character who did not know that world so that then the reader could, and keep in mind that this doesn't come naturally. It's not like I'm like, oh, well, obviously you need this guy. It's more that like you're reading the first draft and you're like, shit, nobody knows is going to know what to, like, there's no reason for people to be telling each other what's going on. So I need to introduce this character specifically for that.
I understand. Let's jump over to something else. Who is the target audience of your book? Is it young adult? Is it adults? You know, it's got some adult content, nothing major, but yeah, I'll that question. Yeah. Who is the target audience of the book? And did you write for them in mind when you started? Or did you acquire
it? It was originally going, I mean, that's another good question. I originally thought this was going to be a young adult novel. And then as I was working on it, I was realizing that what I was really talking about was the power of community. And that I think it's people who are our age who understand how important that is and who potentially can start to affect change back toward more community as we age, because we're starting to realize like fracturing communities is not a good idea. Like there's a reason we had the churches we went to, the Boy Scout groups, whatever it was when we were kids. And so I think the theme, the really underlying theme, was adult enough that I was like, this is kind of a book more for people who just like a fun and quick read. But that similarly could also be read by a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old.
Yes, I think so.
Pretty easily without any like real hang up. There's nothing in there that's like, I don't know, there's no extreme profanity or anything like that that's gonna screw up a 12-year-old.
Lightly experience. Sexual elements that would align with a teen fiction. You know, I've read stuff like that in other books for teens.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously you were a reader too. I think I wanted to write something that maybe I could have read when I was 10 or 11 even, that would have been like, because, you know, when I was 14, Gray's age, I was reading high literature like Tom Clancy and John Grisham novels. But there was lots of like sex and stuff like that in there. It's just, they weren't, you know, what we would call literature necessarily.
Yeah. Did you have like a mental image of who you thought was going to read it? Like, did you have like, it's going to be an 18 to a 14 to 25-year-old male, and they're going to be, you know, odds are they're going to be upper middle class or low. Did you have that actual mental picture in your mind? Or no, not so much.
Not totally. I mean, I think like,
because we talk about LA and Los Angeles, Hollywood would be very mindful of who have you spoken to, who you're writing it for, where's your audience, where's the money before you, you know, what money are you chasing? You know, you didn't do that.
Yeah, I think that is where I've gotten with writing. When my first book came out, I thought, this is my career now. I will just write a book every couple of years and that'll pay the bills. That was never going to be the case. I think you can do that if you are, you know, if you're James Patterson or you're J.K. Rowling. Yeah, that's a possibility. Or if in the nonfiction space, you want to do like a specific kind, like Ryan Holiday does a really good job of like, you know, he's the guy who wrote Ego is the Enemy and The Obstacle is the Way. Right. And he writes a lot about stoicism. He's able to kind of churn out a book, and he's built an audience around a specific kind of philosophy. Similarly, you know, like Michael Lewis, who wrote like Moneyball and those sorts of books. He's a nonfiction writer who does a lot of research, and you can make a career out of that. My career of kind of writing what I want, that's tough to make a go of. I mean, someday it might be the case that I've written 10 books and like there's enough residuals coming in where I'm making a living, right. But I think it's so much more fun. And I think the potential for true inspiration happens when you let go of thinking about like, what does the audience want? And you write the book that you want to read, and you hope that there are other people out there like you who would also want to read that.
I think you need a marriage of both. I like both. Like I look at Point Break, the movie, going back to movie, but the writer of that said he was, you know, thumbing through the newspaper and, oh, bank robberies are popular. Very popular. Oh, look at that. Oh, look at this story. This is a story I've seen a couple of times of like lawyers and doctors taking up surfing in their spare time. Okay. Picks up a pen. And that turned out great. I mean, movie again. I don't know if it would have been a great book, but film. But yeah, I think the bit of both is good.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be like, you have to notice a hole in the market, right? In some way.
A hole in interest as well, you know, like bit of both.
Yeah. And I think that's where, for me, it comes back to like, wow, I wish there were such a book as this, because I would read it. And then writing that book for yourself, in the same way that a musician would say, like, you know, I want to make music that I would like to listen to.
Yeah, that's true. I've got here, you got a good command of the simile, Mr. Paul Shirley.
Thank you.
The color of unbuttered popcorn. The midriffs slid like charmed snakes. I like that one. He began distributing quizzes like birdseed, and he was an old man in the park. I liked them. how long did you spend coming up with them? Did they come naturally?
Well, first of all, thank you for noticing those. Secondly, I think the ones that work come quickly, and the ones you have to work on for too long have to get deleted.
Right. Yeah, gotcha.
Like if you're like, wow, it'd be great if we could come up with some way to compare this to something else here. And you'd be like, what is the answer? I used to do that when I was like, when I would write for ESPN, I had a reputation as quote funny. And I would notice that like when I had to try to shoehorn a joke in, it was not going to work. But if it just like, if I happened to be in a mood where it just kind of fell out, then it would work. I think that's one of the tricky parts of editing is, and smarter people than I have talked about this, like just because I worked for a long time on something doesn't mean it needs to stay in the book.
Right. I like that. I like that line. Moving on. Did you come up with a collective noun on page 31? You refer to it as a crush of students. Is that a collective noun for a student? I just thought that makes total sense.
Yeah, I cannot take claim for that. I think that we say that in the US sometimes, like a crush of humanity or something. But okay. I like that. Yeah. I mean, like in terms of like a murder of crows.
Murder of crows, a gaggle of geese, a crush of students. I was like, a crush? Because you got, you know, they obviously someone in that group likes one another.
Right.
And then they always hoard together like this. And there's always a couple on the side that are kind of crumbing off. Like, yeah, I just totally got it.
Yeah, I can't take credit for that. But thank you. I should have just said yes. That was
intertextuality. Marie Kondo comes up. Cobra Kai comes up in this. Say anything. A bunch of heaps of stuff. Malcolm Gladwell. Why intertextuality? Sometimes you the fear of it is you can come across as like, I don't know, a bit nitty, like, oh, this is that, you know, can come across as kind of very LA, very Hollywood, very kind of whatever. Your decision to use it, were you happy with it? Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, so like the reference to Marie Kondo is like, does it spark joy when they're moving up?
That's right.
Moving out of the house. And I think that works whether you actually know who Marie Kondo is or not. So I think like when referencing something that could be obscure 10 years from now or 20 years from now, figuring out like, will the audience still be able to understand? It's like using a big word, right? Like if you use a big word, but you also kind of re-explain yourself in the same sentence, then it's not nearly as annoying. And I think that works here, right? Where, so like saying, you know, it's, I think I mentioned like Chuck Klosterman, said this thing about, whoever cares less has the most power in a relationship, right?
Brilliant, so like, brilliant line.
It matters to us that Chuck Klosterman said that, but in the reader's mind, it doesn't really matter. It could be Chick Hosterman. Like, it doesn't matter if you don't already know who Chuck Klosterman is. You'll still get the what he's trying to say by saying that. So, like, I guess I think we'll all be prone to screwing that up, especially as references get more and more esoteric, that we forget that like not everybody knows what this thing is. I noticed that I have a bunch of doctors in my family and they use so many acronyms, like just instinctively. And so then like one of my brothers is a doctor and my mom is a nurse, and then my brother's wife is also a doctor. The three of them will just start talking. And then my other brother and I will be like, we're just going to leave the room because we have no idea what you're saying. And so I think it's important when you're writing to not leave people feeling stupid so that they want to leave the room.
Yeah, no, I definitely get on that. I do have an irritate, like Seth Rogen, it does irritate me sometimes because I find that his comedy will be, oh man, that's fucked up, like such and such in his latest film. Like there is that pan element to it, very pat, but I think you did it quite well. Page 60, you got Paul?
No, I was just going to say that's one thing that I notice about Twitter sometimes or social media in general is that like if you don't know everything that's going on and you try to put your foot in the stream, like you may accidentally like piss someone off without even meaning to, just because like you didn't know that that day everybody on the internet was talking about this one thing and you're like, well, I was just reading Graham Greene. I'm sorry that I like these things do not match.
It's funny. I had a professor from Melbourne University on this podcast, and he gave the best piece of advice I've ever had in my life. Always take the most charitable interpretation. And if you do that on Twitter, on the internet, in life, I think that'll go pretty well. Take the charitable show. Page 64. I wrote, because I your book, like I took it, I've broken the spine. The pages are bent, dog-eared. I write notes in the pages. I hope that doesn't bother you, that your pristine book was...
That makes me happy. What are you talking about? That's the best thing ever.
On page 64, I wrote this. The Patrick Patterson character is a bit of a wink to the camera, kind of a Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She's edgy, funky kind of girl, wise beyond her years, which has become a cliche, but I think you, the author, skidded around that in a way that sort of deconstructed the trope. I don't know if I was trying to be clever to myself when I wrote that, but what was your intention with this character? Because she's sort of that edgy, funky chick who takes the guy by the hand, but you want to do something different with her. Talk about how'd you get that balance right, and were you happy with it?
I think part of it was that I had
did you know this girl? Sorry, was this girl known? Was this girl like?
No, I mean, I think she's like a portmanteau of humans. But I think like upon like as I was writing her the first time, which is to say, like before I even started working on the book, and I was like kind of noodling out what her character was. I think she bloomed so easily, like she just like kind of fell out of me, that I was like, I've done exactly that thing, right? Where I've written the perfect sort of love interest for myself. Yeah. And so therefore I need to take the piss out of this a little bit, right? So like having her be a little self-aware about how, as I said, she's the manic pixie dream girl, which, is, you know, interestingly, my friend in LA wrote an essay that was in the New York Times Modern Love series, specifically called "I Fell in Love with the Manic Pixie Dream Girl." So I like nodded to that friend of mine, even trying to say like everybody kind of knows that this girl is barely able to truly exist, like that it's almost too good to be true. With that said, I do think that there is something to, when you're in high school and you're a 14-year-old boy, there could be a 14 or 15-year-old girl who's so far ahead of you, because 14-year-old boys are we were so behind that most of the girls that I met when I was a freshman in high school seemed like Patra Patterson, not because they actually knew that much, but just because they like their emotional like development is so far advanced. I remember being in love with all these girls who had like bands written on their notebooks. And I was like, I don't know who the Velvet Underground is. Like, that's so cool. So I think like there's also like a little bit of it that is that it almost without trying to, girls can be the perfect girl when you're a 14-year-old boy.
It's unbelievable to look back at girls you had fantasized about, who you just loved from a distance for so long and so hard, and then you realize, hang on, what was I thinking? But yeah, right. They were just a normal person. I thought they were fucking.
Yeah, it's because you were like
stupid.
I don't know. You're stupid, but you're also just like
so regressed.
You're working.
Caveman software.
We were working in two dimensions and they were working in three dimensions. And then when you arrive at three dimensions, you're like, oh, this is just three dimensions. It's not that interesting.
The mother character, Nicole Taylor. She has a story, but Gray is most certainly the main character. The split would be something like 30-70, you know, I think. Mm-hmm. Were you sort of conscious of the amount of screen time, book time she got? Because you seem to want to mimic how a TV drama works, where you have the kids have the A story and the parents have the B story. Talk about her character and just getting her in there to get enough out of her as a character.
I think like that was one of my favorite parts of the book, was that there's a little bit of role reversal, right? Like in some ways, Gray is kind of parenting his mother a bit, because he kind of sees like, mom, you are being ridiculous. Like this is not going to work for you in Los Angeles. Why are you so beholden to this idea in your head? And I like that there is this like late dawning on her in the way that you want with a character, where there's like enough evidence is built up and she starts to decide, okay, I should make a change in my life or my viewpoint. And that it is, in a lot of ways, like it's a sign of how much Gray loves his mom or how connected he is to his mom, that he not only wants to have a better existence for himself, but he also wants her life to be better. He's kind of taking the reins and saying, like, this is how we can make your life a little better. I just loved some of the stuff that came up when talking about what it's like to go from a small town. She was parallel to me going from a small town to a big city, right? Like chasing a dream or whatever the thing is. So, you know, when you write a book, obviously people are going to be like, so is the main character you? And obviously there's parts of you in any character, but like in a lot of ways, the mother is also me, right? Like going to Los Angeles,
I felt that,
from
yeah.
a small place. And also there's a certain, she has a certain sadness to her that I really like. There's an optimism. There's also a naivete around like, just how the world actually works and how hopeful she is at all times, I think.
Mm. Your portrayal of her is quite unique, quite modern. First of all, is there, if I remember correctly, there's a love affair with guitarist John Mayer. Is that there? And then also, you often refer to her as Nicole Taylor. There's very, very few instances where you call her mom or mother. Was that yeah. conscious on your part?
That was like an editing move late where I was trying to send the message. In some scenes, she's mom, and in other scenes, she is her own person. And I think, and some of this might be like my mother went back to school when she was 55 and really I think exerted some agency on who her personality was independent of her kids. And I think that was an interesting experience for me to watch, where, you know, her life had been dominated by childcare and now she was becoming her own human again. And I think that's kind of true for Nicole Taylor, right? She's got one child and he's 14. And so she's starting to move towards like, oh, wait, you know, what is my life like without having to take care of this kid all the time?
Into chapter 7, you had a nice button to end the chapter. And it reads, what if I were doing something else tomorrow after school? I haven't sold that well. I have to read that in the context of the thing, but it had this very Walter Mitty kind of, cigarette out, you know, just made sense. Yeah. It's a nice button. And the endings of chapters, the endings of chapters are pretty important because obviously you finish it and you're kind of like, well, okay, the flight's about to land. Do I go to the next chapter? You know, it's important. Were you conscious of writing, buttons to the end of chapters, and, you know, was it a struggle for you? I quite like them. You know, obviously we talked about Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, she comes to great chapter endings. Tell me about how you arrived at the chapter endings that you did.
I think that's very much a work in progress for me as a writer in general. Because sometimes it feels cheap, you know, like you kind of feel like, well, the person's already this invested. Like, why wouldn't they keep reading? And then you put yourself in the reader's shoes and realize like, oh, they have other things to do, Paul. That's why. And so you got to keep their eyes on the page. So like it's something I think about, but it's also, it's sort of like the first line of a book in that if you get too far into this has to be the perfect blow, as they would say in screenwriting terms, you'll never end up with any good ones because you'll just be always thinking about like, well, it's gotta be like the impact thing. Really? So I think it's more like when it's available, go for it. And if it doesn't quite happen, it's like, as I learned late in my basketball career, so there were so many games where the best case scenario for me is to score 6 points and get 8 rebounds or something. Then there were other games where the best case might be, I might score if things are going well, I might score 25, but you had to wait for the game to come to you. There was no, you can't just decide I'm going to go score right now. And similarly, like when finishing a chapter or writing the first sentence of a book, it sometimes it's available, sometimes it's there and it feels right within the flow of things. And other times, if you try it, it feels really wrong and you would be better off just having a mediocre ending to the chapter.
Square question for people who are maybe writing their own book at home or whatever. Did you have a plan for this book? Were you like, okay, this is how it's going to go? And it, or did you even have it marked out like, okay, chapter one, Los Angeles peril, debating the mood. Did it, were you that structured in the way you were going to write it? Or yeah, was it on the back of an envelope? Or you know, how structured were you coming to write it?
So when I, after my first book, I spent several years writing a novel that ended up being trash.
Do you still have it? You still have it?
I'm not honestly sure. I have, there's also, before that even, I wrote the first half of a different novel that's also trash. Oh, and then after that first novel that was trash, I wrote a second novel that was also trash.
What made them trash? What made them trash? They weren't well written, though, a bad story, bit of both.
They just weren't well written. I think like there was a lot of, I just didn't know what I was doing. And I, you know, I don't think as a writer or a human, you'll ever know entirely what you're doing. But with this book, I spent so much time with figuring out who the characters were and how they were going to interact in the sense of like, well, all right, wouldn't it be interesting if Gray falls in love with the principal's daughter? Because that means that we have to have the principal involved. And wouldn't it be interesting if the principal's wife is also a teacher at the school and like Gray's, that's one of Gray's teachers. So that forces interactions, right? That once I got started writing, they just started doing things on their own. And I think that's, you know, when you hear authors talk, it sounds a little crazy, but it turned out to be very true for this. It turned out to be true for this next novel that I've been working on, where if I knew the characters and then I put them in situations, they would start to make decisions almost on their own. And my job was only to chronicle those decisions, which I think for me is really reassuring, because one of the things that is scary about writing fiction is it could go in any direction, right? But if you let go and just say like, I know these characters really well. I know how they would behave in any situation. Let's put them in a situation and then just write it almost like it's nonfiction. Like, well, that's what happened, because Patrick Patterson would have always done that in that situation. So I don't, it's almost like it, if you do the work up front of figuring out who the characters are, then you do have to do less work in terms of plotting. Cause it's like, well, the plot is what plot is really just what happened. Right. So yeah. The characters, I think, tend to drive that plot, unless you're like, I mean, I guess if you're writing like a murder mystery and you need to hit certain buttons, then it could be a little different.
I've got this written here. A Latino main character. I heard the writer of The Sandlot, or what's called The Sandlot Kids here in Australia. You know that film, right? Baseball movie.
Yeah.
He said he modeled that main character, the Latino main character in that, Benny Rodriguez, the Jet Rodriguez, after a high school bully. He said he was struggling with the thing, and then he made the hero and molded him off this cruel bully he had growing up. Your choice to use a Latino main character, why did you settle on
him? It was, like, part of it is that I'm consistently fascinated with here in the U.S. how we have gotten really infatuated with like ethnicity. In that, when I grew up like in a what would be considered a mostly white
Meriden, Kansas
school district of Meriden, Kansas, yeah. But like we had several kids who were Latino. I just didn't realize it because nobody cared back then,
right?
You know, so like. With Gray, it was not so much an overt choice. It was more that like Gray's mom had gone to LA and I imagined her for some reason getting wrapped up with an MMA fighter. And that if he was an MMA fighter, like it would be kind of interesting if he's Venezuelan. And partially because that feels like it would have put Nicole Taylor's dad in a little stress, because he would be like, what, this guy's like from Venezuela, like what a weird choice for you to make. And then the fact that he did turn out to be kind of a piece of shit like makes that more difficult for Nicole. So it was more that it was more wanting to put pressure on the characters through potential hardship that they might face. And so then that filters down to Gray. Like if he's half Venezuelan, he doesn't present as quote, Latino most of the time. He looks like anybody else. But if somebody does find out about that, then they might be able to use that against him. And that allows for like some conflict, as happens at the school dance where the girl he's dancing with, like, calls him a wetback. And like, and then it's also kind of comic because he's like, well, that's not right. That's not the right slur to use. I think that is kind of funny too. Like playing with, you know, the way people talk and also like making fun of how seriously people take this stuff in general. So yeah, it was like, it became a whole thing in my head as far as just ways to put pressure on the characters in the same way that like in my life, being a white basketball player made for a more interesting story because I was the minority in that world. Right. So like there was a lot of me being the outsider. So it probably helped me to make Gray a little bit more of an outsider in that regard also.
I think it's kind of like a Matryoshka doll, like you were the majority in a situation mm-hmm. where you were now the minority. And I think if you haven't felt yourself in that situation, it's an interesting one to be in. Mm-hmm. Page 86, there was a dispute between Gray and his mother. And these folks seem a lot less likely to try and sell you Adderall next to a dumpster behind a subway on a scorching Thursday in August or pull a box cutter on you when you say no. But we talked about it a little bit at the top, but what did Hollywood, what did Los Angeles do to you, Paul Shirley? Good. I mean, and I want to ask this question. This is a question I've got written down. Is Hollywood corrupted by actors or are actors corrupted by Hollywood? You know what I mean?
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, you know, because every school bully, every good looking dude, every prom queen is heading out to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's a concentration of all those people who are successful in high school. It's not a natural environment. You need a few people who didn't do so well. Yeah. So I've often had this thing where like, is Hollywood the corruption? Are the people that are attracted to the corruption? Maybe a bit of both. Mm. But yeah, Los Angeles did not agree with you, Paul.
Yeah, maybe it was brewing this whole time. I mean, I think what's disheartening about LA is when you get there, there's the American dream story of I think it's a Guns N' Roses video where he like arrives in town with his guitar or his suitcase and he like unloads in Hollywood and then he goes to, you know, make it. And I think that we want to believe in that fairy tale, whether it's a musician or an actor or a writer. When you get there, you realize like most of the people with jobs are children of people in Hollywood already. And that there's a smattering of people who'd like show up in LA and like make it as an actor or something. But most of the time that's just not the case. And I think there's a constant population of the people who are LA fixtures. And then there's just this stream of humanity who comes in and out, and a lot of them are there for 18 months before they realize like, whoa, this is never going to work for me. I should not have tried to become a model because now I'm a stripper. And I think that's what can be depressing about it is that there's this magnetic force of the sales pitch of like, yeah, come here and let your dreams come true. I don't know. I mean, I think there was partially that for me, although like there's not a lot of book writers in LA. So
no.
I was able to, in some ways, stay clear of that because I was not trying to act exactly. I think actors get it the worst because,
yes,
for better or worse, there are 25 actors in the world who are so good at acting that they are always going to have a job. But then a lot of everybody else is like, he looks exactly like what this part should be. And his acting level is maybe this much higher or lower than the next guy, but it has a lot more to do with fit or connections or yeah, whatever it is, which is actually a lot like basketball, right? Like yeah, in basketball, there are, I don't know, let's say 60 guys in the world who are very clearly the best and are unimpeachably so. And then there's the next 600, of which I was one, where it's like, does it matter if you have that guy? If you give him enough shots, he's probably going to be fine. But there's also a world where that guy ends up in Russia or something and nobody ever hears from him again, and vice versa. Like there's a guy playing in Russia right now who could probably be the eighth man on the Denver Nuggets and nobody would bat an eye.
This is a theory I've come up with recently. And I think COVID is starting to really put an edge on this. Like, when you look at the pyramid, you're like, wow, what a great success. And then you're like, oh, hang on. That's just slaves. That's just throwing human misery at it. And then you build it. And right. It's like, oh, Beyonce's music, amazing. And you know, she dances well. Oh, hang on. She's got the world's best choreographer. That's just a slave. Mm. It's just a slave behind the scenes. And it's everything. It's all this stuff where it's like anyone who's, like, I'm often watching a movie and I'm like, okay, that actress looks amazingly beautiful in that scene. And I'm like, oh, hang on. She's got a team of maybe 40 people. Someone's doing light. Someone's doing camera. If it's not quite right, it's stop. It's do it again. It's you know, all day working on 10 seconds to make them look amazing. If everybody had that many people making them look amazing or feel clever or write a good book or make a good film or build a pyramid, it would get done. And they'd get that credit. And I've just never, and COVID especially, you saw those people, those celebrities singing that song and you're like, oh, hang on, when there's not a team of people helping them out, they're as goofy and dumb as the rest of us. So.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think like that's, you know,
done for
what
me.
That's actually a good analogy for even the creation of this book, right?
Right.
So like when a book comes out and somebody is like, wow, this book is self-contained, full of something, whether it's good or bad or otherwise. And what you don't see is the 6 years that went into it and the number of other people who read even my book, right? And I'm not, and this was not a James Patterson book, right? So like it doesn't have an entire team behind it in that sense, but it still has a team, you know, of probably 15 or 20 people. Like my cousin is my first reader of all my stuff. And then my brother will get a hold of it. And then five more people will read it. And then it's sending it to, you know, hey, look, could you take a look at this snippet and figure it out? I think that's a lot of what we mistake for talent is a skill at hiding the work.
I like that.
When you think about, even again, back to basketball, like a lot of our job as athletes was to kind of give the impression that we just rolled out onto the court and just started playing, and that there wasn't the training room 3 hours beforehand, and then the shots before the game, and then the plan that the coach made, and then these set plays that, you know, people may not or totally understand. That I think that illusion has always been true and has always kind of bothered me, right? Like I one of my missions in writing about my basketball days was always like, this isn't as glamorous as you think. Like, here's what it's really like. And in some ways people don't want it. Some people like that. And some people hate it because they actually don't want to be taken.
They want the fantasy. It. Yeah. It's the blue pill, red pill, you know, matrix. Yeah. So, yeah. I want to talk about the nature of flirting, Paul. Like, you bring it up a lot in the book, and make pretty like quite incisive little comments about it. And I've written down here, page 98, I'm going over it and I just can't find what I actually, and here Gray accidentally did something smart. He said, oh no, hang on. Where is it? But I've lost it now. But you make these comments where, you know, sometimes saying not caring was a good move and things like that. And I found it quite daring on your part to put that in there. Did you feel like you were giving core advice to a young reader about the nature of flirting? Honestly.
I think I was probably, I was probably giving advice to myself at that age.
Right.
Maybe. What I love about Gray's age, when I first started this book, I actually envisioned that I would someday write four of them, like one for each year of his school.
All right. And
I don't think that's going to happen at this point because there's too many other things to do. But I think there's something so fun about your teenage years because of the things are so visceral and so impactful. And so like you're learning lessons really quickly. And I think I was just trying to kind of express how, when, as you were in that zone of 13 to 15, you go into it not knowing anything and you come out of it. I mean, I didn't come out of it knowing anything still because I was very slow bloomer, late bloomer, but I think some people are able to like, they're just, it's like an injection of knowledge of like, whoa, like that scene in, Dazed and Confused where the older guy is telling the main character like ask her if she's got a ride, and then when she asks you if you want to ride with her, you just say, I got my own way. And he's like, well, but I want to ride with her. And he's like, trust me, it'll work. And then it, so it's that kind of,
I remember that. Yeah.
Right. Where you're like, oh man, like, cause like when I was 14, all I did was just sort of like follow girls around like a
puppy. I know.
Whatever you want to do is fine. And then as I aged, I start to realize like, oh shit, they don't really respect it when you don't have your own personality.
Why? Of course, it's the most simple right. leap of logic, but it takes 20 years.
Great. Yeah.
Unbelievable. What do I got here? You take a swipe at Star Wars somewhat.
Oh, do I? I don't remember. Tell me more.
Page 151. You go Star Wars. You use the word amateurish, which I actually agree with. You say how you talk about the scene where it's like, trust the Force. You know, if someone says when you're shooting the basketball, just throw it up there. Just don't think too much.
Right. Right.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't you get into controversy a while ago over like the Beatles or was it the Rolling Stones? You didn't think they were a particularly good artist. That caught, I don't even know how I know that. I didn't read an article on that. I think I just saw a headline.
Yeah, I didn't read into it. I did get into trouble because get this, I called the Beatles overrated. I didn't even say they were like bad or I didn't like them, but I was like, it seems almost impossible for them to not be overrated since they're the number one rated musical act of all time. Of
course, right.
So like the chances are pretty high that they're overrated. Like there's almost no chance that they're underrated. So yes, I did take that stand mostly because I get annoyed when people who were not around for the music to arrive on the scene claim that that's their favorite music. Because like contextually I think your favorite music happens because of the time and place you're in, and also because of your understanding of like what came before it, which can only really be experienced when you live through it. Like, you know, I could in a historically accurate way, do archaeology on, well, this band came first and then they came the Dave Clark Five and then Beatles were at the same time. And like you could do that, but you can't really feel it. Yeah. So I'm always not trusting of people who are like, yeah, my favorite band's Led Zeppelin. And you're like, you're 30 years old. How's that? That can't, I mean, you can love Led Zeppelin's music, but I want to hear who your favorite band is because that's how you fell in love with music when you were 17 or whatever. Yeah, the thing is. Anyway, with Star Wars, yeah. I've been
amateurish. It is. It's an amateur movie. You take the soundtrack out of that movie and it's not particularly good. Well, Darth Vader's helmet has got fingerprints on it. It's not that sexy. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
I think it was I watched Star Wars, and maybe this happened while I was writing this book. I watched Star Wars with a Dutch girl who had never seen it and was seeing it for the first time as an adult. And she was like, this movie is like clunky as shit. And I was able to watch it through her eyes and I was like, damn, I loved it because it came out, you know, Star Wars came out the year I was born, but I probably didn't see it till I was seven or eight. So like for me, it was an amazing movie when I was eight. And so therefore I've given it a pass this whole time. And I think that's what people do with the Beatles. They're like, the Beatles were amazing when I was 16. So they're the best band in the world. And you're like, we've made progress since then.
And that's why this is a far departure, but I don't know if you saw a film called Yesterday about the Beatles.
I wanted to see that because I
do indeed. You must see this, and I'll tell you why. Oh, but you're about to say you go.
No, go ahead.
You need to see it because it talks about how if no one knew about the Beatles now, if their music came today, and some guy remembered it, and he's the only one who does, and he played it, he becomes super popular. And I was like, this movie, it wouldn't happen. The Beatles, if they played their music now, it wouldn't be popular. It's not the time. It's not the play. You listen to their rockabilly stuff. It's like, this shit would be laughed off the stage now. And I know they built what came, but the film was exploring what would happen if it just arrived on the scene. And I was actually frustrated by that film for a number of reasons. Actually, really, really, maybe gave me pause and made me think, but as a film and the story, I absolutely hated it. But I was like, no, the Beatles wouldn't be popular. If you sung a song and the lyrics were, she was just 17, you know what I mean? That wouldn't climb up the charts. People would call the police immediately. So, and that's in the movie. There's no filtering of the Beatles. And I just thought this is wrong, man. And I hated it.
Look, I love that take because I tend to feel the same way. In that, like, it's so I own a 1970 Chevelle, and it's an amazing car, right? Right. It's beautiful. I love it in its way. But to say that it's a better car than a, I don't know, 2021 Aston Martin or something is kind of an insane statement, right? Like it's, yeah. it's a prettier, it's maybe prettier to me, or it like, it speaks to me on some level, and it, it is what wrought what came after, but it's definitely not a better car. No. So like, just, I think just admitting what people mean by like liking or their, what their taste is, like you were saying, like I can respect that the Beatles begat the bands that came after them, but I also can respect that the Beatles ripped off people who came before them, because that's how the world works, right? Like, so
it is.
I mean, I think
people, great artists copy, great artists steal. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think like there is, for some reason, the Beatles have captured the imagination, specifically because of the timeline of John Lennon dying when he did. And then also Paul McCartney staying alive as long as he has. Like, I mean, we could talk about this for days.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find fascinating about the Beatles specifically is that when I was born in 1977, which is a year Star Wars came out, and I think it's the same year that Elvis Presley died. When I was a kid, there was a debate between people who were Elvis Presley people and people who were Beatles people. They were like, it's one or the other for best musician of all time. Because Elvis had died, and because he died in kind of a pathetic way, I think his legacy fell off very quickly, whereas Paul McCartney kept being alive. If Paul McCartney had died when John Lennon died, and if both of them had died in a sort of like pathetic, bloated way, I don't think that it would be that true. But people forget, like, Elvis Presley was the biggest thing in music for a very long time. And even in the late 70s and early 80s, he was still considered like the thing. Right. Yeah. Like you could have a very reasonable debate, because the 60s in 1977 had only been 15 years before. So this would be like talking about something that happened in 2006.
Yeah.
And it was still very recent in people's minds. Anyway, this is not a music podcast, and but I appreciate you letting me talk about Elvis Presley.
Going back to Star Wars, I want to make this point quickly. Like, people, it's got its own cult now. And when you watch it on TV, that film was never designed to be on a DVD or on TV before in 1977. And to be honest, long after, probably till the mid, early 80s, the VCRs come out, that film was made with the anticipation of, you buy a ticket, you watch it for an hour and a half, it flies by your face. You don't, you're not able to pause and go, hang on, is that fingerprints on the helmet? Hang on, is that a boom mic? Did that stormtrooper hit his head? It wasn't designed for that. It was designed to just fly by you and just be actually a little bit shitty and fly by your face. And then you're like, oh, fuck. Oh, shit, I can't pause. If I want to see it again, I got to buy another ticket. Like, it just changes the way movies are. And as a result, yes, Star Wars is amateurish. But let's go back to this book. I love the moment on page 173 when Gray is entering the game for the first time. And it's a big moment in his life and in the game. And then you write, A referee was waving him onto the court with the urgency of a man who wants to get home. And I liked it because it's self-deprecating and ironic. It's a reminder that as important as you feel in that moment, there's someone there who's is totally ambivalent and you're insignificant to them. And it, but I wanted to talk to you about the nature of irony. You know, like, I don't know if you've read Infinite Jest. I haven't. The David Foster Wallace, his big catch cries, you know, irony is the song of the bird that's learned to love its own cage. I don't think he created that, but he certainly bangs it. Talk to me about that moment that you wrote that, and then you know, that sense of irony in this book.
Well, I mean, I think there is a bit of better understanding by me of how important some of those things felt when I was going through them. And now that I'm old enough to understand like what my parents were going through, or what, like I, like you mentioned, the referee was going through, there is I think as we age, hopefully our egos are deflated a little bit and we realize, ooh, there's a whole bunch of other people out here who are having experiences and their experiences are intersecting with mine, and mine is not necessarily the most important one. So I think that it's easier potentially to write about a high school basketball game as a 43-year-old than it would be if I were a 14-year-old, because, you know, if I were 14, it would be impossible to keep it in
dramatic
in and sort of context. Yeah. So like I think that's probably part of the adult nature of the book, is that there is a little bit of a wink at people as far as understanding that this is happening within a much bigger world.
And you were conscious of that. You wanted to impregnate the book with that and not you didn't want to live in that moment? You didn't want to indulge that fantasy of Gray's? You wanted to kind of nip it a little bit?
I don't know if I wanted to or not. Mm. I think it was more just that, like, because that's what I was probably thinking about in that moment. It was just inevitable that it would come up, right? So it wasn't, I would be remiss if I took credit for any sort of like wanted to do this. It was more just like, that's kind of what I was thinking about at the time, probably. Sure. And in the same way that I will infuse other books with things that are near and dear to me now. And 5 years from now, I might be like, I don't really, I mean, it's like it actually kind of comes back to that Beatles thing, right? Like I probably tossed that article off in 3 hours in two different drafts, mostly just to push people's buttons. And then it became like a brouhaha where I was like, whoa, guys, you were supposed to devote 8 minutes of time to this. And now you're writing me hate mail about how I should not be allowed to write about music anymore. That's a little weird, right? So like, I think a lot of these things, it's kind of like you were saying about the Star Wars thing. A lot of what we produce is meant to be consumed once and then not like.
And you know, sometimes the reaction to something should be like, huh?
Right.
Shut the book onto whatever it is you were doing.
On to the next, yeah.
A while ago, we were talking about flirting. I couldn't get the quote. Here's the one I liked. Gray was learning how flirting worked. And flirting was a lot easier when you had something in your life that you felt good about. And really, that's sort of a flagship for confidence, or just sort of not actually being totally present, kind of being there, but also, and there's a bit of this with you, we're multitasking, this kind of thing. We've lamented Hollywood and movies and everything, but page 263, if you were to turn this into a movie, you wrote your tagline, he had a game to win, full stop, and a town to save, full stop, and a girl to get. That's the tagline if ever I've seen it. So I don't know if you wrote that consciously or not, but
I think I was like, I think that's probably, that was, I could get away with that because I've built up the reader's trust for 260 pages, you know, yep. Like that's so dun, 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 that you can, that's allowable now. I mean, I think that's what's one of the things that's, I think fun about working on a book is the progression of trust, right? Like catching someone's attention, clarifying that you're not wasting their time, then clarifying that they're in good hands. And then as you go, you can start to take chances in the same way that's true for public speaking, I think, right? Like if you were doing a talk or even comedy, you have to kind of like make sure the audience knows they're in good hands first. And then you can start to take some chances along the way.
It's funny you mentioned comedy, because in the margins I scribbled here, like, and we were again talking about the decay of Los Angeles, maybe even widen that to big cities. There's never any comedy clubs in small towns. Mm. There's not the need to manufacture laughter there. And I've lived in a lot, and you get there and you're like, hang on, this is the funniest place on earth. And there's no, they're not trying to bottle it. They're not trying to fake it. It's not someone doesn't sit at home and rote learn a whole lot of funny stuff and then come in and pretend it's offhand. It's just genuine. And sometimes the results can be pretty zany, but
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but you're probably onto something there.
Something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think like right now, especially because everybody's so afraid to be honest online, and online is also kind of a proxy.
Online's a document. Space. Online should be anxious. Once you write it there or say it there, it's there. It is a written document as anything else, and endless and spaceless. Right. So I'm not really negative on people who are sort of anxious about doing stuff online. I totally get it.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, reiteration of the title, Ball Boy, typically a lowly title, you know, the ball boy, someone who doesn't play, managerial type role. But in this one, Gray, the character, main character, is bestowed the nickname, and it's like because he's not a ball fetcher, he's got balls, courage. Reiterating the title. When did you come across doing it? You know, and when did you pick the title? Was that why you picked it, Ball Boy?
I feel like I see these are the sorts of things where you're like, it sounds like I didn't write the book because I don't really remember, but that's because it's right. been 7 years, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But my recollection is I picked the title because I was like, ooh, that's catchy and will sort of send a message. And then as I was working on, there's a little very minor subplot of like Patra is trying to give Gray a nickname.
Yes.
Throughout. She's trying to figure out like, what do I call you? Because everybody's got their thing. And that storyline was in danger of going away because it wasn't really connecting. And then I was like, wait, what if we made it a bigger storyline where it pays off in him getting the nickname that is also the title of the book? So I think it was more trying to rescue that storyline than it was necessarily trying to
plot device.
Or, yeah. Make it so that was the reason for the name. Although, I mean, I remember with Can I Keep My Jersey, this is one of the reasons that I didn't love being published by Random House, because they kept trying to screw things up. So Can I Keep My Jersey is an amazing title, as it turns out. Like, it says everything that you need to know about what the book is about. And I spent so long figuring out that title. When I did, I was like, yes, this is it. Because you don't see a lot of titles with question marks in them either, which is kind of fun.
I was about to ask you the idea of posing a question. Now you look online, editorial stuff, what I do with the sports stuff, it's always like, will this player sign? Will they do this? Questions within titles have become very in vogue. And
yes,
that one predated it by a good 10 years.
So I was like, I was happy with it then. When I tell people that title now, they're like, yep, that's a great fucking title. But back then, they wanted to change it to A View from the End of the Bench, which was not really what the book was about. Because I was like sort of known for being the 12th man for the Suns, but the book was more about the ups and downs of sometimes being like the main event, you know, in certain like minor league teams or whatever else. So in the finished or the final draft of Can I Keep My Jersey, I finished with, I think, something about the Suns letting me keep my jersey. Like, that's the last line. And my editor was like,
at least it didn't work out, but at least they let me keep my jersey. Yeah, that is the
right final line. So like, my editor was like, oh, you're really fighting for that title, because I had sort of made this conscious decision. Like, I'm going to make sure that this title sticks. So I have thought a lot about since then, like how titles, should kind of be incorporated within the book in some way.
This is the question I most wanted to ask you. And this is, I'll put a note in here. Spoilers for anyone who hasn't read the book and you want to read it and don't want to spoil it. Spoilers from here on out. That's such a funny thing to say. But anyway, the final act or conclusion of the book. I think one chapter you kind of end on a critical moment. I think the game's in the process. It's coming down to the wire. Mm-hmm. And then the next chapter, boom, we speed by all that. And I mean, it was daring. I was like, oh, hang on. I was quite enjoying that. And I was like, okay, all right, I'm reading, Paul. Okay. So the climax of the book is done in retrospect. You're sort of like, oh, by the way, you know, they're at the diner, I think. They're like, oh, yeah, we kind of won that game. And it's not like it was a winning shot. You're like, yeah, we won it 48-64 or something like that. Right. It's very, why'd you make that choice? What an interesting way to tell the story. And you must have felt quite like, was there an element of like little sort of a shitty grin, cross the arms, like I'm doing something different here? Like the nicest way to put that.
I think there's it's first of all, like
mischievous is a better way to say.
Yeah. Thank you for asking that, because it's so fun to even get to like dive into that. Honestly, what was going on was that I felt like I had described enough cliffhanger basketball moments and that there wasn't a cliffhanger basketball moment in the offing, other than the fact, like the real climax is him making the decision to take the leadership role and go get the poster off the wall. Like that's the true emotional climax. And I also like, you know, there's a world where this book ends in the state championship game or something. And I think it kind of harkens back to what you were saying about the irony of all of this is like, well, they ended up with a winning season, but then they lose in the second round of the playoffs or whatever I kind of say in the postscript. And so I want it to be like a big story for Gray personally, and also maybe send the message or remind people that when you're 14, it all feels big. it's enough that you decided to go pull the poster off the wall and that you guys won the game and that the people came to the diner afterward and all that. Like, that's sufficient. And that's also what's so fun about writing about teenagers, is that things, you don't have to explain why it's a big deal. It doesn't need to be a Marvel universe entry where everyone's trying to save the universe. It can just be like, this kid just wants like to be sort of, he wants to fit in. He wants to show the town they have a little better thing going than they realize. And he wants to maybe get the girl, and that's enough, you know?
Right. You weren't at all worried, like, am I leaving my readers who've come with me for 300 some pages undernourished? Mm-hmm. You weren't worried about that?
Well, I felt like I didn't feel
undernourished. I can clarify that. I didn't feel, I thought it was cheeky. I thought like, okay, yeah. Okay, this is different. I like different. But I was like, this is a lot of people who are in that vein of, I want to see the guy get the girl. Honestly, may have felt undernourished. But yeah, go on.
Well, I think like good screenwriting advice is to get in late and get out early. So in a scene, wait till the last possible moment before you actually, so like, you know, the highs, how are yous are irrelevant. Nobody gives a shit about that. Right. And similarly, like once you've done the emotional payoff, like there's, I don't know that there's a lot left to say. And so to me, it was the case that like the emotional payoff has already happened. We're going to get a little denouement of like Gray and the parents and a sense of like, oh, are they never going to get this? Oh, they're finally getting it. But to me it was, it just felt, and I guess some of it is like in the writing, it felt like even the act of writing anything more about that game would not feel fun. So therefore I feel like the reader,
I totally agree. I totally got it. I felt that gap. I thought it had reached its pinnacle. I was like, and also you've got to remember, you know, this book exists in a world where there's been other books and movies about basketball.
Right.
So it is like, we don't need to know the conclusion of this game. The game has concluded. Yeah. I agree with that. The themes of this book, what? Legacy, appreciation, nostalgia, place, purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that are all the major themes to me.
Yeah. Community, belonging. Yeah. Purpose is good. Like you said, like feeling like, I feel like in Los Angeles, it's really easy to get lost in, what your purpose is. Like I found a really nice community in Writer's Block that I helped to generate. But otherwise LA is a pretty lonely place. Like there's not a lot of,
as is Sydney. Yeah.
Really? Is it really?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Big cities, you know, it's not Los Angeles big, but yeah,
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something about like New York doesn't feel as lonely to me because you've got your corner, grocer or whatever, and you're like your restaurant down below you that's maybe not all that good, but you go to it anyway, which feels like a little bit more like a small town. Like even when I lived in Barcelona, the various neighborhoods I lived in, you would get to know like, well, this is my little neighborhood, and it felt like there was a community that developed within it. It feels like LA doesn't quite have that. So I wanted to communicate that, like, you know, a sense of belonging is vital to all of us.
You obviously started this book, well, 6 years ago, you started it well before COVID. Was part of you like, oh, hang on, what's community in a COVID world? You know, and quite honestly, were you kind of like, oh shit, how does my message or the moral of the story about community translate to a COVID world? I don't think you made it. You don't reference COVID in the book, I think because you just hadn't written it at the time. Does the moral of the story for you change in a COVID world?
Man,
the practicality of it, you know, does that change?
Yeah, I think that's something we're all going to wrestle with when it comes to creating content.
Yeah.
In that, so it's so tempting, I think, to want to add the context. Like you'll notice in Ball Boy, there's not a lot of mention of the use of cell phones, or there's a little bit of talk about like Gray's mom using Instagram. But it's so difficult to predict what will make sense to people 5 or 10 years from now. So like, you know, in can I keep my jersey? I think the, if you want to contact the author, inscription says to find me on MySpace.
I can't recall, but that is funny. If it does, so that is funny.
I'm pretty sure that that's what all it says, right? Because it was 2000.
That was everything. Yeah, right.
I don't know what year it would have been. 2007 or 8 when that
book
came
out. Yeah, sounds about right.
And even then, like MySpace was the dominant form of communication if you wanted to like get hold of a stranger. Like now I will just put my email address in there because who cares? But I think like there will be a lot of things written about a current COVID world or post COVID world that will not hold up very well because 10 years from now, people are like, well, I don't know. I mean, it was a big deal, but like it didn't turn out to change things, or maybe it does. It's just impossible to predict.
Yeah, right.
Really how that resonates.
Here's my last little thing I've got for you. I want to talk about tangible impacts of your book. You know, this book is about community. This book is about making real positive change, no matter how small. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we were talking about Into the Wild. It's a book I'm just obsessed with now, but in that book, it kind of reads, the importance is not being strong, but feeling strong, you know, and I like that. I think that's kind of a similar vein to your book, but two practical things from your book. I really like the line, having fun is the best way to attract people. It's a line you put in there where I think he's dancing like an idiot at the dance typically. And I thought that was a really good piece of advice. And I've enacted on that and thought, yeah, that's very true. But here's, and this is, you might think this is silly and ridiculous, but a tangible positive impact of your book. I read it, finished it, probably maybe 2 or 3 days later. I then went and cleaned the microwave in my office kitchenette. Unprompted. It's been dirty for a long time. But as I was cleaning it, I was like, this is exactly what Gray Taylor would have done. No, I'm not getting anything for it. I'm taking time out of my day a little bit, but it's a communal thing that we all use. I know people lament it being dirty. It's right. been dirty for a long time. And all it takes is just one guy to take on that personal responsibility of cleaning it. And I felt like Jesus Christ, because I didn't tell anyone I cleaned it. And I was walking around the office and I hear people go, someone's, the microwave's clean. And I didn't, I was just like, oh, really? It's clean? No, it's, maybe the cleaners did. I don't know. And it was Gray Taylor, honest to God. And that's as best I can, you know, that's a palpable positivity you put out there with the book.
Fittingly, I glanced up at your name on the Zoom call that we're using to record JC. It's in there.
It's in the genetic. But yeah, that's so. Yeah, that's, if that,
that's really cool to hear. I mean, I think one thing I've decided on with writing books is that if you can get 10 people from the beginning of your book to the end, that's a win, right? Because think about like how many books you want to read, how many books you actually read in a year. Yeah. So if somebody spends that much time, if 10 people spend that much time with your book, that's a win. If it goes beyond that, where, you know, somebody connects to it and feels like, you know, it in some way makes them feel less alone, then I think that's an even bigger win. I actually just last week got a note from somebody who I had sent the book to. His daughter had actually, long story, but I had been in touch because I was going to be in his town. And I said, hey, we should get a coffee. He did not respond. And then 2 weeks later, he responded and said, I'm sorry, Paul. My daughter was killed in a car accident a week ago. Oh, wow. And so I've not been emailing very much. And then he said, my son has been reading your book and really loves it. And we just switched to me reading it aloud with him in order to cope with what our family's going through. And I was just like floored that he had taken the time to write at all, you know, in the midst of this, but then B, you know, that's not to say that my book is going to be any sort of savior to them, but the fact that it has any influence on their life at all in a positive way means I was feeling like, that makes it all worthwhile. It doesn't matter how many copies it sells or anything like that. It just, I think that's, you know, you don't want to get too high-minded about literature or art, but if you can just touch one person or ease one person's suffering, then I think you've done something worthwhile.
I think that trumps my cleaning the microwave at work story. But they're both good. You can't debate that.
They're both very good.
But yeah, I really liked it. To everyone listening, you know, buy a copy and read it. And isn't it fun? Like, I normally just read classics, authors who are not only dead, but long dead. So it is fun to read a book and know that the author is in your time. Man, the Beatles are not your favorite band, okay? Dickens is not your favorite author. Paul Shirley's alive and well. You know, you can...
Yeah, give him a shot.
Friends with him. Paul, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was so fun to get to dive into this, so I appreciate it.
And if people want to buy the book, the best place is through Amazon or your website?
Yeah, just go to Amazon.